Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, parents, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and often interrupt our daily lives. Let's tap into the pulse of young folks. This edition of 411 Teen talks common sense. The Common Sense Team consists of teens with diverse political affiliations, all in the IB program at Rickards High School. The panel seeks to analyze and evaluate national, state, and local politics of today. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and joining me here at the roundtable, I welcome.
Hey, my name is Apoorva Srivastav. I'm in 10th grade, and I really like debating.
And I enjoy having you. Yes.
Hi, my name is Sunur Pradhan. I'm an 11th grader at Rickards, and I have an interest in Model UN and global politics.
Okay. Hi, I'm Jackson Burks, and I am an 11th grader still celebrating the Eagles Super Bowl.
Hi, my name is Hannah Kiros. I'm a senior at Rickards High School, and I'm excited for Orthodox Lent to be over so that I can finally have meat and dairy this Sunday.
Okay. Some kudos out to the FSU National High Magnetic Laboratory. It's been awarded $184 million by the National Science Foundation, solidifying its future. The MagLab attracts more than 1,700 researchers from around the world. And special accolades to FAMU. Students emerged as the number one team during the second HBCU Battle of the Brains competition. The FAMU team consisted of grad and undergrad students from FAMU School of Business and Industry and Computer Science. The students used virtual reality technology to galvanize millennials to engage and become consumers. In addition, FAMU New Student Orientation Program received top honors in five areas at the Southern Regional Workshop. So we just want to give a shout-out to what's happening here in Tallahassee. Also, the proposed gun ordinance continues to raise ire for the NRA. A Leon County ordinance is designed to close the gun show loophole and require a five-day waiting period to purchase firearms. Marion Hammer, past president of the NRA, issued an alert to oppose the proposal and attack Marion Lindley, city commissioner. This gun debate just won't go away. As you see it, what are the major issues with gun control, gun debate, and where do you sit? I'll start with you, and we'll just go around the table. It seems like it won't leave us. It's always there. We talk about it, and we think, well, maybe it's died down and something else happens.
So the major problems, what I've seen so far, is that buying guns and students and people that, say, have some type of psychological disorder or mental disorder are being able to buy guns, or people that somehow are unqualified by these guns are obtaining these guns. Mm-hmm. And what these mass protests are, like the one that we've just had in the Capitol, is they're trying to push lawmakers to have stricter gun regulations, and how a teenager in high school is able to buy an AR-15, that shouldn't be something that should be possible. And so these protests, what they're trying to do is they're trying to pressure lawmakers through protests, and they're trying to show that the public opinion is actually reflecting upon tighter gun regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And where I sit is that, yes, we do need tighter gun regulation because this is simply unacceptable. It doesn't matter how many lives are lost. One is enough to spark change. And,
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so I think a really big part of the reason that this problem keeps occurring is that every time gun reform in laws gets brought up, it's a very, like, bipartisan issue, and mm-hmm. people tend to polarize themselves on different views. And because of that, a lot of the neutral or the kind of modest reformist voice get left out mm-hmm. in the issue. So for example, after the Parkland shooting, a lot of people, and I'm not saying this is necessarily a blind thing, but we're massively advocating for a lot of gun reforms directly to the amount of guns people can purchase. And although this isn't something that I necessarily disagree with, I think that changing gun reforms itself should be done in a slower manner. But because of this, people on the opposite side of the spectrum immediately locked up because they said, that's a clear violation of my Second Amendment right. And I think that there are several ways to improve the standard in which people are able to buy guns to prevent mentally unstable people and people of lower age brackets to purchase guns without directly causing all this bipartisan drama.
Share those with us. What ways do you think that we might incorporate that may address some of these concerns?
Yeah, so definitely increased waiting times on being able to purchase guns.
Mm-hmm.
The decrease of magazine clip size is a very good way to start slow progression towards eliminating weapons that are clearly created for purposes other than hunting. And then mm-hmm. also increased background checks on individuals that are trying to buy guns in the first place.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I definitely agree with a lot with what Sonora's saying, that you have a lot of the extremities of both sides of the conversation polarizing everyone in the conversation. And there are a lot of problems in the discussion on guns, both sides misunderstanding each other. You have uh-huh. one side of the aisle that is often unable to compromise on any type of gun control, and you have many people on one side of the aisle who lack basic understanding of firearms and the types of firearms, and they start a conversation on what we should regulate, and that often hurts the conversation because a lot of Republicans who many are gun owners are aware of what type of guns really are a problem. And so they're able to push back on regulation because you have a lot of people pushing for gun reform who can't define you an assault rifle or don't know what type of guns are on the market because they are not generally gun owners. So I think a big problem with the gun discussion is misunderstanding on both sides. But I'm definitely in favor of reform.
Do you have any ideas how we can pull the sides, the different factions together? Because another thing that I see, it seems like those who are supporters of the NRA view gun control as if we want to take all the guns away. And I don't know that that's the case. I don't think that that's the answer anyway. That's not going to work. But, you know, that misunderstanding, that breakdown is where all the problems, to me, you know, seem to occur.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think a big part of starting the discussion is starting in the middle mm-hmm. and starting with establishing mm-hmm. basics. We have the extremes on both sides, as I said, ruining the discussion for everyone else. And I think what needs to be established by the mainstream on both sides of the aisle is discounting these extreme cases. Even if you lose the votes, if you want to have a true moderate way to regulate guns, you have to discount people saying get rid of all guns. And you have to, as a Democrat, you have to be educated on guns yourself, and or you're going to polarize Republicans and you're mm-hmm. never going to get them to agree with you. And as a Republican, you, in a way, have to discount that any gun regulation is against the Second Amendment while still holding to a traditional interpretation of the Second Amendment, however you hold that to be. It's establishing a middle ground.
It seems so simple. I mean, here we are talking about it. You all have great suggestions. They make good sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it comes to implementing something like this.
Well, like I said, I mean, I'm sure if we flesh it, when you flesh it out more, it gets, a purpose said, AR-15s. What you aggravate a lot of Republicans and me, someone who's interested in guns, the AR-15 is a semi-automatic weapon with no special caliber size. It's not different from any other gun. It's semi-automatic. You can use it for hunting like any other gun. So you get a lot of Republicans get aggravated because we mm-hmm. use AR-15, you use assault rifle, and those terms really aren't the problem. Bump stocks, that's a problem. It's well established. You don't hunt with them. You don't use them for competitive sport. They don't really have a place. And even the NRA, at some parts of the NRA, have agreed to bump stock regulation. But banning assault rifles is not a solution because mm-hmm. that's not a thing. Banning assault AR-15s, that's a semi-automatic weapon with nothing really special about it. And people get confused a lot. I mean, there are people, you'd be surprised how many people think you can get a fully automatic weapon. It's not legal to get a fully automatic weapon. There are no fully automatic weapons on the market. And you'll have people say AR-15s are meant to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you want to look at illegally AR-15. You can't buy an AR-15. You can buy an AR-style weapon, which is just like any other semi-automatic hunting rifle with the same caliber size and the same clip size. It's all the same. It just looks different because people like how it looks. We have to define what type of terms we're using here.
Yeah. Hannah?
Well, something I think that's really interesting to note is that the Second Amendment is 27 words long, and it was also written when the primary firearm that was used was a musket. Mm-hmm. So
you're saying it may be outdated a little bit?
Yes, but I definitely think that I guess to try and quell a bit of bipartisanship, as someone who is a proponent of increased gun control, whenever you propose measures that would limit access to certain guns or would limit access to certain accessories such as bump stocks, you have to kind of couch your argument with the preface of, I'm not trying to abolish the Second
mm-hmm.
Amendment. And even
exactly.
I kind of think that it's a bit ridiculous to always have to do that, but if you really believe in your cause, then I think that you should be willing to make accommodations so that people will listen to you. So, I think that the Second Amendment is something that's vague, and I think that basically every amendment that was included within the Bill of Rights has something that's in place to curtail it to a certain degree, just to keep up with the times. So mm-hmm. I think that imposing restrictions on gun availability, I don't think it's something that's coming in direct confrontation with the Second Amendment, because I don't think anyone in Congress is seriously proposing abolishing guns or abolishing the right to own a gun. And I also think one reason why we have a lot of trouble discussing gun regulation is because a lot of researchers are restricted with regard to research that they can do regarding gun purchases.
Mm-hmm.
And especially something that I read about today that I thought was really interesting is that the AFN, they place limitations on the statistics regarding what gun shops are being utilized by criminals to or people that are mentally ill to perpetrate crimes.
You're tuned into 411 Teen, and I am talking with students from Rickards High School. This is the Common Sense Team. We're going to take a break, but we'll return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm talking with students from Rickards High School, the Common Sense Team. Hannah, I had to interrupt you, so will you continue your thought? Sorry.
I just think that there's a lot of defensiveness that surrounds protecting the Second Amendment, and because of that, those that are proponents of, I guess, the extreme defense of the Second Amendment to restrict, permit the use of all guns that aren't automatic, that aren't fully automatic. I think they, due to, I guess, a general defensiveness by people that would support that position, they restrict access to information regarding guns, and it's very mm-hmm. difficult to have an informed conversation regarding guns because of that. So I think that any time when a side is restricting access to information, they're fearful that the information that would come out wouldn't serve them well.
Good point. So. Well said. You know, we often, and several of you have mentioned the mentally ill, and I know we can't stay on this a long time because there's tons of stuff for us to talk about. But that issue with the mentally ill often comes up, and I would just like to know how you see it interacting with the whole gun law. I mean, what do you define as mentally ill? And we won't spend a lot of time on it, only because it's always said, you know, that it's the mentally ill. And I don't know how much you know about mental illness, but, you know, one can be mentally ill, and then you might be fine. And so do we restrict them because they were depressed two or three years ago. I mean, I just wonder what you all as young folks, how you see that, you know, when you think about it.
Well, I think it's – I think it needs to be regulated as two separate issues. I think we need to regulate guns. And I think that's a separate issue dealing with mental health in the United States. It's not to be interacted with.
Reading my mind.
Of course, with a lot of people who do these shootings, they don't survive through. So we don't know whether they actually are mentally ill or not.
Right.
And we don't have a lot of very concrete information on whether the amount of school shooters are mentally ill or such. So I think they need to be regulated separately, and that doesn't need to be part of the gun control discussion.
I don't know what the rest of you – how you feel, if you agree, disagree.
This is actually a really tricky topic because I personally think that anybody who would commit kind of a mass shooting in a lot of the situations that we're talking about would be identified as a mentally ill individual by a lot of like current psychological standards. However, the way that psychology labels people as mentally ill is a very, very diverse spectrum. And because of that, I don't think it's justified to say the mentally ill should not be able to purchase a gun as a generalized statement. But I think a lot of the time it is going to be case-by-case scenarios.
Okay.
But also, like you brought up earlier, should somebody who had signs of depression possibly 3 years prior to wanting to purchase a gun be allowed to purchase that gun? I think that's a very, very tricky circumstance. And that at the end, that comes down to the development of that person at the current time. And there's no way to set legitimate laws stating it should be in this situation for everybody if everybody has a different mental stability at that moment.
Any other comments?
Yeah, I agree that I think it's dangerous to demonize the mentally ill because people that are mentally ill or people that aren't neurotypical already have difficulties that they have to deal with aside from us trying to pin the gun epidemic on them. But I think that it would be wise to include a psychological evaluation with background checks. And
okay. I mean, I laugh because, you know, it sounds good, but when you're talking about doing a psychological on everybody,
it's a very extensive and hard process. Months of one-on-one talking
to
determine mental illness.
Yeah,
that's
why I ask you all, you know, just to see where you're kind of coming from. But we can stop on that because as we talk about guns, we can talk about what happened here in Tallahassee. A Tallahassee police officer shot and killed a family dog. It's been on the news so many times, so I guess we need to address that a little bit. Reportedly, the officer was entering the owner's property, and he says this dog came after him, charged after him. Reports are coming out that the dog was old and could hardly climb the steps, and that there was no way that he could charge him. My question is, here we go again talking about guns. I mean, here it is again. Now it's the police, and it's not... Not that it isn't often the police. But what do you think? How should we handle this?
Well, I mean, I think it's very hard to determine. And in general, I would take the side of the police officer as opposed to, I mean, it is, in the end, an animal.
Well, he can always say, Jackson, I feared my life.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's an out. And that's an automatic out.
And
I mean,
of course,
so
you can
it
also
goes
say
no
the
further.
Dog couldn't attack him. But me and an old dog can get the same pump of testosterone and adrenaline that would make him charge someone else. I mean, no matter how old you are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard to say, and I would just take the side of the police officer.
It's just gotten so much PR that I wanted, to hear what you all thought. What do you think?
I guess I disagree with that. I think that if an officer is so scared that he would shoot a dog upon, you know, coming into a scene that was potentially violent, then there's a high potential for that officer to make the same mistake with a human being.
Okay.
So I think that they should definitely. I think the department should investigate and probably put that officer on a leave of absence at least for a short period of time because they. I think that we have to hold our police officers to a higher standard than we would regular civilians. So while it's understandable that they would feel afraid, they should be taught to, you know, regulate those feelings in order to make reasoned judgment calls. And I'd also like to say, with regard to mental health, I just think that the mental health history of someone that's attempting to purchase a gun should be considered. I understand that forcing someone.
No, I'm not saying it shouldn't be considered. But see, when we get into that, then we get into, you know, HIPAA and right. There's so many. It's like opening a can of worms.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. So that's why whenever that mental health thing comes up, it's like, well, now you know that I had a problem with depression. And who else is going to know? Mm-hmm. Because once the gun seller knows, where does it go from there? So and we didn't even get into it. I mean, we could go further and further. And I just know we didn't have the time. So, you know, that's fine. Okay. Any other comments on this gun? All right, let's move on. Governor Rick Scott has about a week to respond to several bills for the 2018 legislative session. One bill that has also received a lot of attention is the toilet to tap. You know what that is? Oh, okay. Y'all don't know. What? I've come out something you all don't know about? My goodness. The toilet-to-tap water bill proposes that we recycle toilet water, okay? And you recycle this chemically treated water to a point where that you can drink it, okay? And he hasn't decided on that yet. He hasn't signed it. But some critics are saying that recycling this water can contaminate the aquifer, meaning that this water, even when it is recycled, will still have some medications in it. It will still have some chemicals in it. Of course, just the thought of drinking toilet water, I mean, is not the most appealing, okay? But it's a real bill. I mean, it's out there. So I wanted to get your opinion on what do you think about it? Where do you sit, okay? As you think of, I've given you basically the basics of it, and that's basically what's it.
So going off the basics of this, I mean, to me it kind of sounds like it's pretty repulsive to me, I mean, drinking toilet water. But I know there has to be always two sides to the debate. And I know the one side that you gave me was that it would be contaminating the aquifer. But then
others are saying it's fine.
Yeah, then the other people would be saying that in today's society, we have the technology, we have the means of recycling this water because we already take water from sources that are way worse, like just in the natural world. So you have to also consider the other argument and to people who say, like, I mean, including me, like it's kind of a repulsive thing to do. I mean, we are already recycling water from other sources. And when you do that, then if you actually like look into where we've been getting this water from, then looking at drinking toilet water is not necessarily that bad of an idea. Mm-hmm. Although that idea in a lot of people's minds is
people can't see
weird.
Your faces. Everybody is kind of like, ooh. But you raised some good points, and that's, you know,
not saying that I should support drinking. I'm drinking from bottled water right now.
Of course, we don't know where this has come from.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I hate to be the person to say it, but the concentration of germs and bacteria on a door handle is actually higher than in a toilet bowl. So, I mean, if we're talking about the repulsion of drinking toilet water, I think people have to account for the fact that what people visualize as toilet water is not what we would be consuming.
Right.
However, in terms of the chemical filtration process that would enable us to do so, I believe that even for the sake of efficiency and reservation of resources by passing this bill, if it means harming the aquifer and natural lakes and reservoirs in the area, I don't think it would be worth it. Because over even the past 10 years, Tallahassee has been seeing a massive trend in increase in pollution in the in our local basin area. So I don't think speeding up that process would benefit anybody just for the sake of more efficiently taking care of our water intake. So.
Okay.
When you have controversial reports on each side, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, If it were to harm the aquifer, obviously I don't think – I would be against harming the aquifer. But if it is let's say it's less harmful to recycle water than it is to extract water directly from the aquifer like we do,
yes,
then perhaps it's a good bill to have. But I honestly couldn't say
– Yeah. No, I don't expect you to say it. I just want you to respond and react to it. Yes.
Yeah. First, I think that whoever came up with – The moniker for the bill, the toilet to tap, like it's very bad branding, like if you're trying to get it through. But I think that it's not an unreasonable thing to consider, because I know that South Africa is going to run out of water like soon.
They've been having serious water problems there now. Yeah.
And I know that the U.S. is in South Africa, but California has also been dealing with water restrictions and the drought there. So we're definitely going to have to be like very innovative, and we have to be willing to utilize resources that we haven't utilized before if, you know, the U.S. is going to effectively combat water scarcity, and if we're going to, you know, take steps towards sustainability. So I do think that the benefits to sustainability would be tempered by any adverse effects to the aquifer, but I don't think that it's an unreasonable thing to consider.
Okay. The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School students are very concerned because now they are required to carry transparent backpacks. Many students oppose it, you know, saying it violates their privacy. As students, where do you all sit?
I think it is absolutely a great step for the school to make. I think if the students are going to have an outcry for gun safety and such a thing, when a backpack is such an easy place to hide a firearm, I think it's completely reasonable to have clear backpacks. I mean, you're going to enter a government-owned building and receive a free education, then you are subject to not being able to bring whatever you want in your backpack. It's not a problem if you're bringing just what you need for school. And obviously this will cut down on, I'm sure, a lot of the school's drug problems. You can't bring it to school in your backpack. And a lot of things, I think it's a huge benefit to the school. I think the students have no real argument for not having it. It's what they've been wanting. There are a lot of schools up north, a lot of private schools actually, who use clear backpacks. And I think it's a wonderful step and a good way for the school to combat a lot of things.
I'd like to hear from all of you. What are you saying, Hannah? What do you think?
I think it's definitely it's a good interim step to make students feel more safe in the short term. But I think a more ideal solution would be to install metal detectors at different points within the school. And I know that a student protested the clear backpacks by filling his backpack with tampons. It was like a male student, is a joke. And I get, as a student, not wanting everything that you have to be on display, even if you're not bringing any contraband into school. Like, I know my backpack is a mess. Like, it would just be, kind of stressful to see that on display. So I understand students not wanting to have to, you know, have everything that they own on display. But I know that a lot of students coming back are also probably very fearful. I guess I think the school is really doing its best to just make students feel as if they're doing something to ensure their safety. And I think this is, not the worst step.
It's not the worst step.
Personally, I think it's a good way to eliminate fear that these students have. When they go around and they see that their peers, their fellow students, have clear backpacks, then they know that what's inside their backpacks am I in danger of another attack. And really, it shifts their mind away from another attack to them focusing back on school, what they should be focusing on. And it's really a good step made by the school to drive those students back into their curriculum, back into their school, instead of constantly having to worry, is the kid sitting next to me about to shoot up the school? Clear backpacks, I mean, as far as privacy goes, what you should be bringing in to school is a pack of pencils, a notebook, I mean, multiple binders. If you're a girl, then the this stuff
it
that you
that you need.
What you need to bring in to ensure that you're clean and healthy. And other than that, I don't think you should be bringing anything other to school that you should be able to protest with, like, oh, I'm bringing this into school, it violates my privacy. Well, it's a school, you shouldn't bring it into school in the first place.
Okay.
I definitely see the use of clear backpacks in school as a great way of providing peace of mind to the students. However, I don't see it as a long-term solution to the problem. And also, I do see it as an infringement on the personal rights of the students because I believe that they should withhold – they should hold the right to hide the items that they do bring to school every day, even if it's in terms of something that they don't want people seeing when it's not illegal. And I think that by allowing – well, by forcing students to bring clear backpacks, it will give them peace of mind that, you know, I feel more safe in this environment, that I know that the people around me don't have illegal substances or weapons in their bags. But also the argument can be made that if somebody did want to commit a mass shooting in a school, they wouldn't be afraid of it being seen as long as they entered campus before they were able to do so. So there are always ways of hiding things that you don't want entered without keeping it in a transparent container.
Do you all feel safe in school? I mean, given all this, I just wondered, has it had an impact? Do you feel safe? Do you question or wonder? Or?
I think, and generally, yes, I think I feel very safe in school. I mean, yes, it is very – it's a big problem that students are being killed in schools. But for me, realistically, I mean, you have so many schools in the United States. I mean, thousands, and you have only so many that have been shot up, and you have only so many children being harmed in these. It's a huge problem, but it's not a personal concern of mine, really.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break. We have just been talking about local and state issues that are going on, and we will continue after this break.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and I'm talking with students from Rickards High School, the Common Sense Teen. I had to interrupt you before you got started, Hannah. Now it's yours.
I was just going to say that I thought that it was good that the Leon County School Board voted unanimously to not consider a provision to arm teachers,
like the
Guardian program.
Glad you brought that up.
So I think that I definitely feel safer knowing that none of my teachers could potentially be armed. I like all of my teachers. I think they're all mentally sound, but that's still like a scary prospect of having like a gun in the classroom. So I think that makes me feel safer. I know today when I was eating lunch, I heard someone scream outside, and I was like, oh, no, what's going on? I opened the door. There was a couple girls having a good time laughing really loudly, like screaming. So I think that, like, whenever I hear sounds that are kind of alarming, like, that is, like, I guess when I think of, like, danger that could be, like, falling upon the school, like, school shooting is the first thing that I think of.
Okay.
So, I think I'm typically too busy in my day-to-day life to allow that to really stall any of my activities. Yeah. But I do think that the fact that the Parkland shooting happened in Florida makes it a little bit more intimate. And I think that especially like being able to watch some of the students speak at the Capitol made me realize that it's definitely something that that can happen.
And as we talk about teachers, I think, you know, nationally, teachers are descending on all types of capitals. I mean, you know, from we had in West Virginia and Arizona and Oklahoma and Kentucky, you know, we're having these strikes. What do you feel? How do you feel about this? What options do teachers have? And why are they at the bottom of the totem pole? They're the most important to me. I mean, you know, they're super important. They're at the bottom of the totem pole as far as getting pay. And they're having to strike to get you know, decent pay.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, and you see, I mean, especially in the way it was done in Kentucky was very suspicious. It was snuck in on a separate, I believe it was a sewage bill. They snuck it in at midnight, the Republican Congress in Kentucky, where I was born. Mm-hmm. So I have some family friends who were actually part of that strike. And I think it's part of the process in a lot of these, especially Republican states where increased pay and benefits for teachers are not on the table. That it's unfortunate that it's come to this, but I do think it is a very effective way to get this done because, frankly, congressmen or statesmen in these states who school shut down on their watch are not going to get reelected, and they're going to change it real quick. That's what happened in West Virginia. That's mm-hmm. probably what's going to happen in Kentucky. And frankly, I don't understand. I mean, you look at different professions, the more you pay, the higher quality people are going to come do these jobs. If you pay teachers more, they're making as much as a doctor or a professor. Now, that is obviously very unrealistic with public funds and stuff. But if you do pay them more, you will attract higher quality teachers and more people will want to work in the public education system.
But that makes common sense.
Yes, it does.
You know, and as we well know, mm-hmm. common sense ain't common. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, where you all sit with these teachers? Teachers are an integral part of all of your lives.
Yeah. I think one thing that I think is really cool about these strikes is I think that teachers are typically like not given the respect that they're mm-hmm. deserved. And I think
Indeed.
That with the pay that they receive, they typically end up living a lower quality of life than I think would be becoming of the job that they do. So I think that it's really interesting that through striking, you're kind of forcing the government to recognize what an integral role they play mm-hmm. in their state. So, I think that, again, I think a lot of these strikes are going to be very effective. And I think it's not really ideal that governments, state governments, don't recognize the essential role that teachers play unless they go to such lengths because I mean it's something that
everybody had a teacher.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, so it's not a question of are they valuable? What service mm-hmm. do they every one of them, all the congressmen, all the legislators, all of them.
Yeah. So I think that it's a positive movement. I think that teachers are very smart. I think that organization is something that they try to impart onto their students, so they're pretty good at organizing it. Or I think they've just been really effective on the whole, so I think it's good.
I mean, teaching is an incredibly honorable profession, but mm-hmm. the salary and benefits that teachers get don't reflect how much honor that these people deserve. These people spark interest in young people's mind. They mm-hmm. lead your future. They are pivotal, sometimes even more than your parents, in deciding like what you want to be in the future, how successful you want to be. And I think the teachers that are going on strike, they're really speaking for every single teacher everywhere, because these teachers are not being paid as much. They're mm-hmm. not having as much benefits, and that as they said, that reflects how much quality they put in, like how much money they get is how much quality they put in, and that's how much quality your students are going to have. And again, that reflects your state too. If your students are doing worse, then there's obviously a problem. And if a state is doing better than you, then obviously they're doing something better than you. And I think that really there's a really a root in the salary and benefits that they get.
Okay. I think it's great that the teachers are definitely defending what they believe is their rights, and I think it's definitely a great way of creating progress in this area, and that teachers should generate more income than the income that they're all currently gaining. And I can't really say anything much more than I completely agree with what they're fighting for.
Okay. Laura Ingraham, you know who that is?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Laura Ingraham viciously attacked a Parkland student, David Hogg, airing all the colleges that denied him admission. I mean, he called for the advertisers to drop her. I mean, places like Wayfair and TripAdvisor and mm-hmm. I don't know, Office Depot, and it goes on and on. How do you feel about this? I mean, I won't say anything.
Yeah.
of course, you can see my face, I guess.
It made me really mad because I heard that student speaking about it on CNN, I think. And he wasn't even the one that brought up his colleges. It was a CNN anchor that said, like, what college would reject you? You're so eloquent. Because I thought he was very eloquent, too.
Yes.
And then he said, he just listed, like, the four colleges that rejected him that week. And he said, like, yeah, it's disappointing, but I want the activism that I am engaging in to be an example to other students of how, like, despite whatever rejection you get, you can still go on to make positive change in the world. So don't allow that. Don't allow, like, a rejection to define your self-worth. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a really good message. And I definitely don't think that he was whining. And Laura Ingraham, who is an adult with, like, power, who should definitely know much better. She said, like, David Hoth is whining about his college rejections, which he definitely wasn't. And then she also cited, like, 4.1 GPA. Looking at those schools, it's not surprising that they would deny you. And, like, he's a smart kid who's gone through such tragedy. And I think that trying to belittle him that way speaks to – I think that's – like, it's just a very, like, actively and transparently mean thing.
Right.
And it – like, it just made her look absolutely awful. So – and a lot of brands have been breaking with her. So I think I want that to continue. That's good. I think that a lot of the students that have been, you know, called to activism following the Parkland shooting have been conducting themselves really superbly.
I do, too. I applaud them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They've done a good job.
Yeah, with those statements, I mean, she's playing into the argument that a lot of her base has accepted. That is, we're going to reject the opinion of these high school students because they're high school students.
Yeah, they're high school students.
Because they shouldn't determine our policy because they're high school students. They don't know anything. And that's playing to that base, and that's what she's doing there. And I mean, they are high school students, obviously.
Yes.
They're not professionals, but their opinion is very valuable, and what they've gone through is very important. And they're not writing the laws or anything. So, I mean, this is just part of the –
But they will be voting. That's important.
That is the big theme.
I think that's really important.
That is the big theme in the next election, the presidential election. But I think this is just playing to her base and what they want to hear.
Yeah. I think it backfired. Do you think – I mean –
I don't think so. I think among the NRA, I think it's continually popular among where her job lays, and that's the 5 million NRA members.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can go on the internet and you'll see 1,000.
No, I'm not saying she's losing her job, but I think she didn't think she was going to get the pushback that she got. I don't know.
I think she did. I think she knew what she was doing. I think she very consciously knew what she was doing and who she was, whose support she was going to get and who she wasn't. And I honestly don't think she cares that people who are non-hardcore NRA Republican members hate her for it. It's because the NRA members will continue to support her because of that thing.
Well, time will tell. Because I'll tell you, no matter what, money talks.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
I think, if anything, her kind of belittling attacks on the Parkland student only served to polarize the gun debate issue even further, like we were discussing earlier. And I think it's kind of these comments that are used to devalue other people's claims and other people's opinions that that other people who might have already had slight ideas against what Parkland students are facing, it would cause them to further polarize their opinions against those of the Parkland students who want more gun regulation purely on the basis that they think that they have more support if they polarize themselves and they join this group of people who they know, all of these people agree with me that we should defend our Second Amendment rights. And I think kind of circumstances like this only cause harm to progressive development in our bills.
Okay. So I mean, first of all, I really don't understand the thought processing that she had when she was doing this. But one way I would explain it is that in that scenario, she didn't have a sort of intellectual argument to counter what he was saying. And so when people don't have that type of argument, they tend to go for personal attacks.
And bullying.
And it doesn't matter how rational it is, they still go for it. And I think it did kind of backfire on her because when she was saying these belittling points, I don't think she had in mind that all these advertisers, all these people that currently support her would drop so much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know you had another comment, huh?
Yeah, something that I was thinking of was the fact that Something that typically that conservatives typically use to delay the gun debate is whenever there's a big shooting, they'll say like, "Oh, we'll give the survivors time to grieve. We'll push off this issue and give them time to deal with the tragedy that's just befallen them." But right after the Parkland shooting, students turned to activism, and right after that, they claimed that they were crisis actors.
Oh, yes, yes. And, I remember that.
Yeah, and I thought...
Was that ridiculous?
Yeah, and I think...
Some said it, that it didn't happen, that they just...
Yeah.
That was the...
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yes.
I think part of the reason why that's done is because since they're children, it's almost as if they have to be completely devoid of any emotion, or they're supposed to, I guess... respond robotically to the tragedy in order to be taken seriously, like with regard to matters of policy. So if they are showing emotion, then they're crisis actors. Or if they're if a college rejection disappointed them, then they're being whiny babies, and then you shouldn't listen to them. But I think the students are definitely conducting themselves with like a very impressive degree of professionalism. But they can still act their age. Mm-hmm. And be taken seriously. So I think it's just a part of a larger effort to discredit the Parkland survivors.
Yeah, actually, in regards to this, I was watching an interview with three of the Parkland students, and one of them said, at first, after we started kind of all of this activism movement, after gun violence was brought directly to us, we did feel guilt for only caring about the issue as passionately as we did after it occurred directly to us and the people we love. And I think... that guilt that they were feeling at that moment is very unjustified. I think that it's kind of society as a whole and people who look at the situation and say, you only care right now because you're in an emotional state or you don't really know what you're talking about is kind of what's making these kids feel that way. And I think that anybody who feels passionately about a topic to any degree is obviously going to be more instigated to rally behind that after something personal occurs to them. So I think it's very ridiculous to kind of state that they only care because it happened to them or, you know, like most high schoolers don't really care about these issues and it's a very minority problem. And I think all of those are just very, very ignorant statements that are made in this topic. So,
yeah. Wow. Okay. We've got 3 minutes. Let's see. What else can we talk about? Well, let's talk about Sunday's front page. Democrat story about the Salvadorian space and deportation. Oh, you didn't say that was this past Sunday.
Yeah.
Under the, what was it? It was the 2001 U.S. granted temporary status following, you know, devastation, earthquakes, gangs. And, you know, it was granted to, Haitian, Somalian, a number of different countries. And now the U.S. is saying that things have cooled down. They're fine. The conditions have improved significantly for Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Salvadorans particularly, and that they can now return to their country. And this has to be accomplished, quote me, I think it's September 2019.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's happening is they're starting to be sent home.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to hear, you know, how you feel. Yeah, go right ahead.
I feel like it's a rather abrupt warning for people that have been in the U.S. for nearly 20 years to suddenly uproot their life and head back home when, in many cases, the U.S., in some cases, is more of their home than Ecuador.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You've been here 20 years?
Yeah, so I guess I do understand the fact that the U.S. can't absorb everyone that's fleeing crisis or natural disasters, but especially in the case of Haiti, they continue to be, like, nailed. So I don't know
what they would have to say it's to. Even more dangerous to go back, and gangs are even more of a problem than they were when they came here.
So I think that if you send people back, which is likely going to be what occurs, you're going to end up with a humanitarian crisis where people don't, even if they have family to return to, it's just it's such an abrupt change of lifestyle for them that I think you're going to end up with like internally displaced people when you send them back. So.
Yeah, definitely in the case of Haiti and some other countries where the necessarily conditions haven't improved, I think it's very unfair to send them back, obviously. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with the concept of keeping refugees for a certain amount of time and then sending them back. But keeping them for 18 years and then sending them back to somewhere that hasn't restabilized necessarily, I think is a bit abrupt and unfair, frankly.
Well, I think we're going to have to close because the clock on the wall is telling me. But I want to extend a sincere thanks to you all for sharing your opinions to my listening audience. Thanks for the privilege of your ear and your time. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.